As much of the world is still marching and protesting the untimely death of George Floyd, we thought this was an opportune moment to discuss protest and activism in one of our favorite mediums, comics. On today's episode, we recall our earliest memories of comic book stories that were meant to do more than simply entertain, such as Danny O'Neill and Neil Adams' run on Green Lantern, Green Arrow in the 1970s, Captain America's Lost Period as Nomad, and a secret history of Captain America revealed in the story Truth with the character Isaiah Bradley. We also get into the inherent conservative nature of superheroes, as well as how social media has become the main platform where many of us show our activism. Sidebar Forever offers its condolences to the families and friends of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. All three recently lost their lives, two of them at the hands of the police. And also, the comics community said goodbye to writer Danny O'Neill, who passed away on June 11th, 2020. He was 81 years old. Rest in peace, sir.
Good morning, Dr. Silberman. How's the knee?
Did you just have a brain fart?
I know Taekwondo.
Stop eating my sesame cake.
You're killing me, Smalls.
Fuck with me, and we'll see who shits on the sidewalk.
Come quietly, or there will be trouble.
Clearly, I wasn't talking to you, big titties. You cherub-looking motherfucker.
While you were still learning how to spell your name, I was being trained to conquer galaxies.
The real question is, what are those?
With everything that's kind of going on in the world, we're at a point now, and today's date is June 6th. Literally, you know, multiple cities across the United States are protesting, and this is in the wake of the untimely death of George Floyd.
Right.
And really and truly right now, the whole planet is, You know, people are marching and protesting and raising banners of Black Lives Matter.
And shooting firecrackers in the background.
Let's hope they're firecrackers.
Yeah. An excuse is all they needed.
Yeah. But I think it's actually kind of an interesting time to talk about, you know, protest and activism and what that means. And going back to, you know, a mention in our previous episode, you know, I wanted to kind of start with our first love, which is comics. Because comics, you know, if I can speak for myself, you know, kind of opened a doorway for me, you know, in terms of, you know, introducing a lot of things, a lot of ideas, you know, a lot of my vocabulary was built on comics vocabulary. And just an appreciation for literature, even, you know, literature that was just aimed at teenagers at the time. You know, an appreciation for literature and stories and narratives. But as it relates to protest and activism, I want to start with you guys. And I sent you the question ahead of time so you'd have an opportunity to think about it. But I wanted to ask you all, what is the first example in comics that you can remember where there was a story that you were reading and it wasn't there simply to entertain? Clearly, there was a message there. Clearly, there was a secondary agenda beyond entertaining and beyond narrative, maybe in the form of you know, like activism or bringing to light an issue that you normally wouldn't see in the kind of good versus evil simplicity of comics. And what age were you? Like, tell the whole story, the details of, you know, your life, et cetera, if you can recall that.
Well, I mean, for me, It was the first time I saw a truly, like, realistic portrayal of an African American in comics. It was with Neil Adams, and it was actually a Green Lantern and Green Arrow team up, and there was an elder black man that came upon Green Lantern and asked him, you know, you do all these things for different people around and throughout the the intergalactic space, you know, the purple people and the orange people and the red people, you know, mm-hmm. but you're based here and, you know, on Earth, and we're going to do something for the black people. And he just is, his head dropped, and he's like, I don't know, you know, it's as he asked the ultimate question mm-hmm. Of, you know, what do you do? You know, I guess the one of the things that facilitates that question is you know, take care of home first. Like, what do you do? What are you doing for your home first? You know, it's one thing to be a hero abroad and around others and things of that nature. When it comes to taking care of those things which matter, your family, quote unquote, you know, what are you doing to take care of the family? You know, so I thought that was kind of profound based on that. So now.
How old were you when you read that, D?
I was probably, maybe.
Because clearly you were reading a reprint. I'm sure you weren't reading this in 1974.
I was probably like 12 years old, man, when I read it. Yeah, probably 12 years old when I read it, and it impacted me. It just, I mean, the beauty of his artwork, first and foremost, I was like, this is not a freaking cartoon, dude. This is a person that the weight of the structure of the jawline and the lips and the brow, the furrowed brow, and the look in his eye of displacement and discomfort, that shit was palpable, man. Yeah. It was like it just transformed it. And I you know, after that I was a really, really staunch, you know, big Neil Adams fan in regards to, you know, comics and how much he got into the overall empathic side of the characters, you know, you could feel it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you, A?
Yeah, well, you know, like Dwight, you know, I guess my first taste of that came in like a reprint of those Green Lantern, Green Arrow stories. And, you know, it was a reprint when DC was doing like the Baxter paper reprints. So I remember finding them for cheap at a comic shop when I was, let's say, probably about 14 or whatever. Okay. And I had read about in Wizard, as of all things around then, you know, hey, these stories, you know, they really brought socially conscious messages and things like that, plus the Neil Adams art and all that. So I made a point to hunt them out. And one of the first ones that I hunted out was, it was the one with John Stewart when he became Green Lantern.
John Stewart.
You know, that's the first reprint I got, you know. and I remember reading that, it was like, wow. And again, I had just kind of started in the hobby, maybe a year or so before that. Mm. So to really see, you know, John Stewart in there talking like this, you know, like, hey, listen, Whitey, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, just all this stuff. And it was like, what? Oh, shoot. You know what I'm saying? And I remember reading that, and I'll be honest, I didn't quite know how to feel about it, because up until then, I was weaned on Image Comics and regular superhero fare, so it was just like, okay, all right. Mm-hmm. So it took a while for it to digest, you know what I'm saying? But once it did, I was like, oh, well, I can see how these stories would have had an impact. And the funny thing is, before I let you get to your point, Swiss, is you can look back on those stories now, those in particular, the Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill stories, and they are of their time in terms of speaking about those certain issues that were happening at that time. Like, some are universal, like racism and drug use and so forth, but some are very specific, you know, just in terms of
overpopulation, religious zealotry, things like that.
And there was another one where they were talking about the they were talking about the Chicago 7, where Bobby Seale had his mouth taped up literally in court. And I believe this happened in 70, and these stories were coming out in like 70 71. So whatever was in the newspaper, Denny O'Neill was, and ostensibly Neil Adams were reading it, and they were just like, we need to do a story on that, you know. So he had this set of, you know, issues that really started to bring social conscious into comics, you know. And you know, some have been extrapolating upon it ever since. But, you know, what about you, man?
Mine is twofold. One, and I was probably, how old were you when you were reading Green Lantern, that Green Lantern, Green Arrow story, Adrian, or Green Lantern story?
Yeah, I got a reprint, found it in a shop when I was about 14.
14, okay. So I can remember, like, maybe when I was 16, and this was around the time that I actually met Dwight. Maybe it was a little before that. You know, going to Oxford Bookstore. And Oxford Bookstore, for those who are not in the Atlanta area, Oxford Bookstore is still around.
Mm-hmm.
Was
incredible.
It was kind of like Valhalla for us. I mean,
yeah, it really was.
You know, just rows and rows and rows. Like you go into like a B. Dalton bookseller or something like that, and they have rows and rows and rows of novels, rows and rows and rows of just comics and graphic novels and everything. And I remember that they had and still have, you know, like a section for like adult comics and a section, you know, dedicated to like underground comics.
Yeah. Right.
So, and obviously, you know, the underground comics were, you know, some of them were super adult in nature. Some of them were simply kind of counterculture, maybe more kind of druggy focused in a way, you know, your weed smoker comics fan or whatever. But I do recall that those comics being there and not having an interest in them, but just being aware of them. And then, of course, being aware of underground comics and you know, people like, you know, like R. Crumb, et cetera, you know, who were doing what they were doing. But I remember that and being aware of it. And then also I can recall, as it relates to race, which we're all three kind of touching on. I remember, so for the real youngsters who are listening to this, you know, there used to be these things called vinyl records, and there used to be these things called 45s, which were smaller vinyl records.
Right.
And I remember when Marvel Comics put out the superhero 45s, which I still have mine.
Right.
And there was a story with Captain America and the Falcon.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they were battling Zemo, if I'm not mistaken.
They were battling Zemo, sir. Yeah.
It was Zemo.
And so Zemo.
I can't remember if it was the record that made the edit or if it was the comic that made the edit. But I remember references to Sam Wilson, a.k.a. the Falcon, where Zemo was calling him Black Flunky.
Dang.
And then in either the comic or the record, I forget which one, maybe it was the record that was edited. They edited it to Your Flunky or something like that. It was some kind of a whack edit where it was but he was Black Flunky and Black this, and I was just like, wow.
Wow.
Zemo is a goddamn racist, yo.
Yeah, he's a Nazi. Shady. What do you expect?
Yeah, well, there you go. But, you know, but then, you know, it was, you know, and so I remember that. And I was just remember being taken back by, you know, the harshness of it. But it was an opportunity, and that's not necessarily activism per se, but it was an opportunity for those particular writers to really bring in real world language and real world situations.
For sure.
To make the story more than just entertaining, but to make you think, you know, about what was going on. And, you know, comics and, you know, activism in comics and protest, you know, in comics and things of that nature, you know, it goes back. I mean, Stan Lee was doing it with the X-Men, you know, back in the 60s. And political cartoonists, you know, have been around since, like, the 18th century.
Sure, sure.
You know, you've got tons of examples of those, even if you were to bring in, for the most part, you know, our former guest and a favorite of Adrian and I, Kyle Baker.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. You know, who in many ways, you know, he's always kind of, you know, dabbled in, you know, socially minded comics and socially minded stories. And, you know, and even his one shot gag cartoon sometimes, you know, will touch on those things. But you guys were talking about like Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and that's certainly like a pivotal point. Like you said, Adrian, of their time, I mean, they were, you know, super like basic. Here's what it is. You know, they weren't trying to be subtle about it all. I mean, certainly not as subtle as something like Mouse, you know, which was, you know, showing, you know, the Holocaust, but through the eyes of, you know, anamorphic or animalmorphic, you know, characters or whatever. But I remember during the 70s, I remember all those, you know, these things starting to come up. So this is after the 60s. This is after the Civil Rights Movement. This is after, you know, marching for peace and for the Vietnam, you know, in the midst of the Vietnam War. And, you know, so you had Green Lantern, Green Arrow. You had that period, you know, where Cap, you know, kind of lost his faith in America. Mm-hmm. And he took off the, you know, his costume and the shield. Mm-hmm. And he became Nomad.
Mm-hmm. Nomad, yeah.
You know, just wandering the earth, having adventures, right. Like, you know, Kane from right. Kung Fu and shit.
Actually, that's the Godfather. My bad.
But and then you have, and again, it's not necessarily like an activist comic, but you do have something where, you know, like The Truth, you know, by Robert Morales and the aforementioned Kyle Baker,
right?
You know, which was a limited issue miniseries, mm-hmm. and you know, it was a play on the Tuskegee experiments, mm-hmm. you know, where in real life, you know, they gave. You know, black men, I guess maybe black women too, you know, syphilis. Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it sure was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And various other kinds of, you know.
Venereal diseases, yeah. and kind of experimented on them. Yeah. And so the idea of The Truth was, well, what if they experimented with the super soldier formula on black soldiers because they didn't value them as much as they did right. the white soldiers.
Right, because they were quote unquote expendable.
Yeah, they're expendable. They're you know good collateral damage to mm-hmm. get to this ultimate super soldier.
Less than
and
human.
That's what Isaiah Bradley was. Mm-hmm. And I can remember I read a I'm talking a lot here, but I remember reading a quote from Axel Alonso, who was the editor of that series, and he said that he had gotten mad because somebody had written like a negative review of the comic, and mm-hmm. he felt like they were doing it because they were being a bigot, or maybe that they hadn't even really read it. And then that person actually read the series and then came back and said something favorable along the lines of, you know, it made him, that person, think, and you know, they thought it was a worthwhile flip.
So on essentially, he was right then. They do the hatchet job without really paying attention to the details.
Well, maybe so. I may be getting this incorrect, but I remember Alonso, you know, and who is a, I think he's a Latino American.
He is.
You know, him saying, you know, that he felt pleased and he felt, not vindicated, but, you know, he was happy that this person came back to the fore. But, you know, Mouse talks about, you know, the Holocaust.
Definitely.
And the plight of the Jews yeah. during the Second World War. Yeah. But there's other kinds of activism within comics. You know, Trina Robbins and another collaborator did a thing back in the 70s called It Ain't Me, Babe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a push against the old boys club of comics back in the 60s and 70s. And there's probably, maybe still an old boys club today, I would imagine, you know, some female and some women creators might point out. And Kelly Sue DeConnick and one of her collaborators did Bitch Planet.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
For Image, you know, which was, and you know, Robbins and DeConnick may not see themselves as activists or those comics that they put together as activist comics per se, or even feminists for that matter. It's just, in their minds, they may be more comfortable with calling them like a satirical take on things. Mm. But satire does just that. What we were talking about earlier is it, you know, it's designed to make you think about something under the guise of like humor and you know, and cheekiness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But y'all started talking about Neil Adams. Did you guys think back as we were preparing for this? Did you guys ever even consider Ms. Mystic?
No. Oh, that's right, because she was like ecologist, an environmentalist type of heroine.
Superhero. That's right. Yeah.
Was she really?
That's, I mean, right. That was part of her mm-hmm. thing.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Because yeah.
what was the villain? Who was it? The villain in that Ms. Mystic comic called The Foreman.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And did he have like a hammer?
A hard hat. Yes. The wow. Foreman.
Wasn't he like a male version of like what's it, Ruby the chick from the 19?
Oh, Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter. Yeah,
yeah. It was like The Foreman. I was like,
he's
got
like
God.
A male version of her.
Neil, come on, bruh, Neil.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just
anyway.
Yeah. But man, you know. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, dude.
No, I mean, while I'm mentioning other, I'm thinking about other possible I mean, other possible forms of activism inside of comics. And I have to say that I would say for a while, it was either the beginning of Alan Moore's run for Swamp Thing or the middle or the end, but there was a really strange shift where it was about the green versus the red. And the green was, you know, was what I guess maybe the plant was composed of, and it was about, you know, naturalization of the earth and how essentially Swamp Thing become this, he was this elemental and he was like a force
yeah,
for,
I remember that.
Yeah. So it's an interesting storyline, and it's like, you know, as I guess as we think of different forms of activism, we think about how things are either trying to assert their worth or appeal to the dominance of those things which are out there to take over and subjugate. So, but yeah, man, just there's a lot of options out there, man. I mean, and little subtle things like I'm in love with the new Hickman universe of X-Men. I mean, I think it's fantastic, man. I mean, the way he's taken that tired series of events and confluence of events and given a new life and purpose, it's brilliant, man. And he does it kind of unintentionally. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but he does it with a green space mindset. I mean, you know, Krakoa, like one of the funniest, you know, throwaway.
On the Living Island.
Yes. Living Island, you know, mutants. But you know what? But the thing is, the fact that Krakoa was there at the beginning of the new X-Men kind of lends a certain kind of, you know, ambiance to it too, which is cool. And he's really delved deeply into the whole mutant organization and trying to get them to go well beyond the pale of what was expected. And he's brought everybody together, man, in a seamless. You know, I'm no longer remains seamless. He's no longer at the helm of it. But for the first two series, which he ran consecutively, you know, House of X and the other one, which escapes me right now, they were two series which he did it on a month-to-month basis that were designed to interact with each other and show the overall scope. And he does something that a lot of people kind of poo-poo, and that's he does a lot of back matter in his stuff. So he'll talk about, okay, this is the situation that the world is in now. And you read that up to the point where it injects itself into the comic, and sometimes there'll be a little small little delineation, like a little segue into what this means for the comic and for the world. And it's just great world building based on that, man. You know, and so I highly recommend the series.
Well, you mentioned Alan Moore as far as his, you know, his writing mm-hmm. on Swamp Thing, and that kind of brings me to another question is had you guys considered the idea, you know, and Moore has been quoted as talking about, I want to say he's referred to some ideas of superheroes and putting on costumes and beating people up as being, you know, maybe fascist or, you know, certainly being questionable. Mm-hmm. You know, he's gone into great detail to talk about, you know, like Rorschach is, you know, he's crazy.
Pretty much.
You know. And that the comedian is, you know, is a psychopath,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that they're not necessarily fascist per se, but, you know, and you hear the term fascist, you know, being used a lot today. And my understanding of fascism is that, you know, it really involves like government coming in and telling, you know, and ordering private citizens using their might and their force against private citizens and against private industries,
mm-hmm.
That's really what quote fascism, you know, at least in its earliest, use of the term where it comes from. But have you guys considered, and I took this page out of our friend Christian Sager's book. I think I heard him mention this on a podcast, on his podcast,
okay.
Super Context, but superheroes in nature are conservative.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, yeah.
They're not progressive. Mm-hmm. They're conservative.
Mm-hmm.
So they use their might, they use their force to take the situation and course correct it back to where it was before. So the reality of that is, really and truly, is that Superman should have been okay with women having limited rights in 1930, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had barely, I think had barely had the right to vote maybe a decade or two before that, right?
That's right.
When did women get the right to vote?
If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was. Oh, somebody's gonna ream me for this. I want to say it wasn't 1919, but it was somewhere thereabouts.
It was like right around 1920.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then Superman was first published in like 38. Okay. So barely a few decades prior, they had the right to vote. But he should have been okay with women having limited rights because he's just trying to keep everything as is. You know, with black people being, you know, being segregated and being in the position they were in terms of oppression, he should have been okay with that. Because villains come along, he fights the villain, but again, he doesn't progress society. Superheroes by nature don't progress society. They just kind of return things to the order that it was. Batman beats people up to make Gotham safer. But, I mean, certainly his resources as a billionaire, he could probably make Gotham a much better place if he was doing more things than run out in the middle of the night dressed up like a, you know, like a rodent.
Right.
But anyway, have you guys given that any consideration or any thought?
I have. Go ahead, Adrian. You can go first, man.
Well, I was going to say with the Superman thing, you know, in his earliest appearances, he was actually socially minded, you know. Like, he was fighting, like, you know, not just bank robbers and gangsters, but also slumlords.
KKK.
Yeah, exactly. And also slumlords as well. You know, just like, you know, people's apartment complexes, you know, are going up in flames. And the slumlord is just like, I don't care. You know, and Superman intervening, you know, just like, hey, bro, no, you can't be doing that. No, man. But what? It wasn't actually until, I would say, probably the late 40s, like post-World War II, and definitely the 1950s, that you really see Superman come more to the fore as a conservative force, you know, that was really more fatherly in a strange way in terms of, let's just keep everything as it is. I'm here to comfort everybody that nothing will get out of line. No matter how crazy the world gets, I'm here. And same thing with Batman as well. You know, he gradually became that in his, like, appearances starting in the 1950s, that fatherly figure. You know, when previously he was working, you know, on his own outside of the police force, but he was basically deputized in the 50s. Like, he was working every issue with Commissioner Gordon and the Gotham City Police to just be like, what can I do? What can I do to help? You know what I'm saying? And it just seemed like over the years, writers like Alan Moore and definitely like Frank Miller started to pick up on those themes and just really extrapolated it to its kind of logical conclusion in that, yeah, they would kind of be maybe perhaps not totally fascist, but like, this is my city. So if there's any crime that's going to happen here, I'm going to take care of it. You can also say, like, with Batman, that's kind of jacked up, this billionaire going out in the dead of night dressed up, but you going into like Crime Alley, the poor ass neighborhood, the hood, and just beating up old thugs. Man, I'm like, look, I know you want to stop crime, but that's a very, very fine line between vigilante and wanting to take care of your society. It's like, who are you to say that? And why is a billionaire doing that? There's too many billionaires now that are trying to do stuff for that sake and just say like, hey, I'm just doing it for everybody's good. Really? That's, you know, that's something to ponder. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, here's what I'll say. I agree with both of you, what you guys are saying. I think it's a twofold situation. Firstly, I think Batman and Superman are both products of the success that they are. Because I'm pretty sure in the very beginning, neither one of the creators, any of the creators, had the idea and concept of them being a conservative, you know, icons. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think because they drifted in and out of the public conscious for so long, you know, that people started lending credibility to what it was they were doing, and therefore they became these truth, justice, in the American way, and, you know, the city is my city. The city is my city. You know.
But you know what, D, it's funny you mentioned that. Like even like someone like Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She's not an American. Why is she wearing stars and stripes?
Right.
Why is she wearing red, white, and blue pants?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because, you know, once again,
she's an ambassador from another country. Right. Any ambassador who comes from another country, they're wearing their flag and their colors, not our colors.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. I'm interrupting.
No. Sorry. Point taken. I mean, again, you're showing the weaknesses and frailty of the design and concept from which it came. You know, I mean, come on, honestly. I mean, Marston, Professor Marston was had other ideas.
A whole other sidebar, you know?
Which may be coming to a theater near you soon, as we're discussing. But
right?
No, man. You know, yeah. Let's not go there. But you know what? I find it interesting that based on what Marston created, the aforementioned Alan Moore did his own spin called Promethea, kind of based loosely on Wonder Woman, and it was a brilliant. Right. Breakdown and deconstruction of what the female heroic myth was in the 1940s through I guess probably the early 90s
modern day case may be.
Modern day, and he took it into the future, man, and he did a great service to his own idealisms as well as feminine agency. I mean, he had like all kinds of generations of Promethean women. That had the monogram passed down from generation to generation to a new girl. I think her name was Sarah. Sephi was her name, and it was just great. It was a great expose on the power of femininity and the quote unquote macabre that he believes in. But you're right. I think they are conservatives by nature.
Not conservatives.
Okay.
I'm not saying conservatives like with a capital C. I'm saying they are conservative as a sensibility.
Got you.
As a sensibility. In other words, they don't make the world better. They just make it orderly.
Okay.
Well, you know, and they return things to the
status quo.
A status quo. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, you know. I mean, I could start to pick that apart, try to anyway, but for the most part, I totally agree with you, you know. So I think that
there are certainly some examples maybe that we could come up with, but in general, as they were written by, you know, mostly the guys, mostly Jewish and Italian guys in the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very simple, good versus quote evil. Mm-hmm. You know, evil kind of tales.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was going to interject another thing that I just thought of, just in terms of comic book characters being conservatives with the lowercase c.
Nice.
The telltale difference between the companies, you know, has been DC tends to have those type of characters that are all about maintaining that status quo. Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. They have a whole league for Christ's sakes, devoted to
let's just keep everything
normal. Exactly. Don't nobody get out of line. Whereas Marvel is all about change. And you could almost venture to say that Marvel, especially obviously during the 60s, was kind of at the vanguard of activism. You know what I mean? Like you have, Spider-Man, one of his best friends, Harry Osborn has a drug problem, that becomes apparent, the multiple times that Captain America has had a crisis of identity with the country that he was sworn to protect.
Cap been messed up in the head since they thawed him out, yo. Let's just go ahead and call that what it is.
That's a freezer burn, yo.
He was never right, yo. That's the one thing about his portrayal in the movies that I missed was he was always tortured. Oh, I'm not supposed to be here.
Right.
I feel like an old man. Right. Bucky. Right. It was like every episode, every issue, everything. And I really missed. The tortured nature of that late 1960s, 70s Cap, where it was just, Rick Jones, you look like Bucky. No, I don't.
I mean, you may be drawn like him.
Yeah. Okay, when I put on the red and blue pants and the mask, maybe I look a little bit like your boy. But I don't look anything like your boy. Shut up.
But
go ahead, Agent. I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. It's cool. In fact, that segues right into what I was saying. In particular with Cap, he's always, I won't say always, but he's been a particular vehicle for certain writers to come along and use to espouse activism. Most definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, most recently, in fact, within the past decade, you have, there was a crossover called Secret Empire that kind of dealt with, the rise of Hydra as, these Nazis, quote unquote. you know what I'm saying? The new Nazi, you know? And people are extrapolating that. I keep using that word, extrapolate. I'm sorry. But they keep using that as a corollary to, like, the real world issue at the time. We're talking, like, 2016, 2017. So we're talking about, you know, neo-Nazism.
The rise of the alt-right and white supremacists.
Exactly. And, yeah. So that's really starting to, you know, come into focus along that time. But also before that, you also had like a Civil War where he sided with the heroes that were going against the government sanction and Tony Stark. So he was with this band of outlaws himself, because he was like, that's not what this country was based on. So I can't represent that. I got to go with these outlaws. And just, you could go back and see various storylines during the years where he's had that. And it's just very curious how, you know, Captain America as a character, when done properly, you can really use to a limited degree. Like, there's some topics that he really can't touch. But to a limited degree, you can write some form of activism with that character to speak on, you know, broader topics that affect, you know, the real world as far as American culture. You know, I just think very interesting.
For sure.
And I would suspect that part of the reason for that is because Captain America is a symbol. He's a bunch of ideals inside of a costume. Mm-hmm. So you can use those ideals and point them in different directions probably more easily. Or the idea of taking those ideals and then pulling the rug out from under them, you know, as was done in the 70s during the Nomad era, where it's like, oh, you know, all these things that I thought were really important, you know, they're... You know, I find out that they're a lie, or that, you know, that the people that I'm working with and working for, you know, are not who they truly claim to be. So let me ask you this. Do you guys think that protest and activism in comics is effective, and is an effective way to promote change, or to push back against certain systems, social and politically? And the reason I ask the question is, and if you know, going back to us talking about the first times we encountered these things, we were kids, we were teenagers and preteens at the time. Most of the people who are reading comics today are not that young. They're adults who probably have their own ideas about, you know, right and wrong, and the systems that are in place in our country and in the countries of, you know, people around the world. And so they're probably in a much more fixed state than we were. So I wonder if telling those kinds of stories, I'm sure there were some post 9/11 stories that were activist stories. I'm sure there are some people would point to the new Ms. Marvel as an activism superhero because, you know, she's a Muslim teenager. You know, or, you know, any of those kinds of things, you know, the quote forced diversity, that's activism within comics. But again, the median reader age of comics now is probably much, much older, probably two, maybe three times what it was when we first encountered that stuff. What do you guys think?
Yeah. In fact, you hit right upon what I was going to say, Swain, just in terms of the reading age of comics, where your mind is still malleable to these new ideas and, you know, thinking differently about your world. They used to be aimed at like kids, and it's just like, it's not that way now, obviously. And I think now the thing is in terms of protest and activism within comics, it's, again, it's going to sound bad the way I'm going to say it, but I'm just going to say it anyway. Like,
good point, sir.
Everybody wants representation. That's not a bad thing, but at the same time, it's almost just a cacophony. You know, it could be like, where does it end? But just how do you make it cogent, you know, to make sense and everything? Like, you know, there's a comic out from Valiant Comics called Faith. And it's about a plus size superheroine. You know what I'm saying?
Blonde.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. I didn't even know about that.
Yeah. Blonde. Yeah.
Plus size. Activism for my big girls. BBW's
exactly.
In the house.
So you
where
got
you at?
Some for
where
that.
You at?
All right.
I see you, baby.
And then obviously, like we intimated last episode, There's even, you know, with Marvel especially, just really putting out initiatives for, hey, we're trying to put out more black creators, more LGBTQ creators, you know, we want these stories told. We want, you know, stories from this perspective. And it's just like, it just seems like everybody wants to be an activist. And I know, especially these days, it is so, so prevalent. It's so important, actually, you know, to raise awareness and to keep awareness of these issues. So hopefully we can think about them and do something about them. But we're all adults for the most part, and the people who read these books now are adults. And
right.
It's tough to go back on your mindset. Like, a lot of people don't want to change their minds, even when they're presented with, you know, evidence to their learned behaviors, you know what I'm saying? Mm. Their learned thought processes. And I just wonder if using comics to that end, as far as like protest and activism today as it stands, I don't think it's very effective. I don't think it's as effective. I think it's only effective as far as someone saying, hey, we're representing this group over here, we're representing this cause in here. And almost the novelty of, oh man, they got so-and-so in a comic book. And that's where it ends. That's it. That's where it ends. You know, it doesn't go any farther past that. You know what I'm saying?
Man, I'll say this for diversity in comics, and I'll say this for the idea and concepts behind it. And it's, I keep going back to my same old tired refrain, even in these days of prime upheaval and massive change in our social structure and strata. Forced diversity in any situation is not the first thing you want to focus on when telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
The story is a story. Human beings are human beings. Let that be the focus first. Those other things will come along as peppering and flavoring for the story, but no way. But they should never be the focus of the story. Because you are browbeating this person in the situation, you know. I don't care that Batwoman is gay, you know. Does it matter to me? Does she kick ass? What is she doing to further the goals and Bruce Wayne's absence in Gotham, you know? Who she sleeps with is none of my damn business. Who she wants to be down with is none of my damn business. Yes, it can come up in terms of conversation and whatnot. I guess because I have the I sit in a position of male dominant authority, because I, you know, society is driven by males and things of that nature. So I can say that with kind of offhanded and not dismissive purposefully, but at the same time it's like, man, you know, I'm gonna read the story regardless of what the characters may be, who they may be sleeping with. It doesn't matter to me. Like when I found out back in Alpha Flight days, for example, I found out that North Star was gay.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't freak me out at all. Didn't care. It was not a thing for me. So okay, he's gay, and you know.
Well, D, let me pause you there, because okay. When I found that out, I mean it didn't freak me out per se, but it did make me think. Wait a minute. There are no other gay characters in the Marvel Universe.
Right.
And there's a plethora of characters.
Right.
Nobody else is. You know, no other dudes are dating dudes. No other women are dating women.
Right.
No other dudes and women are dating dudes and women.
Right.
Like, nobody's right. Bisexual, nobody's anything. So I think that the point that, like, it's like when we were talking about, you know, the idea of addressing race and overpopulation,
right,
and religious zealotry in those Green Lantern, Green Arrow books back in the day.
Mm.
Those were the first early attempts to do that. So, you know, they're done in a pretty simplistic kind of out front kind of way.
Right.
And then we see something like Mouse come along, you know, a decade later, and it's more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And we see something like The Truth come along, and we see it be very artfully done,
mm-hmm.
and actually rooted in history. It's almost like, you know, like historical fiction in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Super historical fiction, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see so what happens is we're just kind of at a crossroad where everyone's doing the thing, but they're doing the thing in a very obvious way, mm-hmm. because there hasn't been much of it prior to now.
Mm-hmm.
So once there are more examples, and once kind of the the new car smell wears off of these kinds of things. You know, this idea of diversity and, you know, we're going to change this character into an Asian character. This character is going to be in a wheelchair. This character is going to have vitiligo. This character is going to be this, and all. Once the novelty of that, once the sheen of that is off of it, then it just becomes, okay, it's not a big deal to, you know, for any of these things to be written about as superheroes, and it becomes more normal.
Right.
But I think because we're at a point where it's not normal, it just seems, and like, I don't really love the idea of calling it forced diversity. I think it's intentional diversity, meaning it's like a buffet. If you go to a buffet and you always get the veal parmesan and the steamed broccoli and the macaroni and cheese, that's your business.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But if you're at a buffet, you have to make a choice to try other things.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it is intentional diversity. They are inserting that in on purpose.
Yeah. Right.
But I think, like, as far as comics are concerned, I don't think that's to the detriment of comics.
No, it's not.
In my opinion, I think, you know, if comics are shrinking in terms of sales, it's because the audience is just getting older. They're dying. They got other things to deal with.
Right.
You
know? Right.
So.
And the stories aren't engendering any real interest. Like, you know, I think it's a thing wherein, you know, I think one of the biggest upheavals in the story I can think of recently was several years ago, and you guys want to help me out with that. It was where the two, it was a female alien and I don't know, it was male and female. I think one of the characters was black and female, the other character was like an alien or something, had a child, and she showed her breast or whatever, and there was a big upheaval.
Oh, Saga.
What was it called? Saga. Yeah. That was like one of the biggest, you know, biggest upheavals recently I can think of in terms of, you know, oh my God, we, you know, this is unheard of. Why is she bearing her breast in the comic book? Well, kind of, you mean in a matronly way? Because they've always kind of bared their breasts. It's a question of like what they're doing with them and whether or not they're feeding their child that you're having some kind of problem with. You know what I mean? Like we were talking earlier, and this may be going to the podcast, but the whole idea behind, you know, sex being an uncomfortable thing to discuss in modern culture, wherein you could easily pull out a gun and blow somebody's damn brain out. It's no problem, but sex is a problem. Mm, and I think that
women, well, now keep in mind, breastfeeding is not sex.
It's not. But I mean, but no, it's about the sexualization of the breast. You know what I'm saying? So people are seeing it. It's because and the problems with because they're sexualizing that person, and thinking that's what it's for when it's not. It's for nourishing.
I thought that when that happened, without this going down off rabbit trail,
right?
I thought when that happened, that was more of a push against people, because at the time there was a real kind of a public thing of women wanting to breastfeed in public and people being made uncomfortable by it.
Okay.
That's what I thought that was speaking to, not the sexualization of the breast per se.
Okay.
I could be wrong, though.
Yeah, because it was because Dave Dortman was the most vocal one about that, about, oh, why is this on the cover, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, just calm down, Dave. It'll be all right.
Right.
It'll be okay.
We love you, Dave.
But, exactly.
You know.
Yeah. Last question, I guess, for you guys is you know, moving outside of the discussion of comics and superheroes, activism in real life has largely moved to social media.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, right now there are people marching in the streets, you know, literally all over the world. I'm not doing it, and presumably you guys aren't doing it.
No.
But, you know, a lot of people use their social media platforms as a way to, you know, put forth their beliefs and, you know, what they stand for, or what they say they stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you guys think about that in terms of it being an effective way to promote change. You know, there are kind of pejorative terms being thrown around, like, you know, SJW, social justice warriors, when...
Mm-hmm.
Really, it should be, you know, SMW, social media warriors. That's really what you're talking about. But do you guys think that social media is an effective way for people to talk about things and to promote ideas, social and political, that, you know, that they think are correct or progressive?
Without a doubt, I think it's a media which is not going anywhere. It's at our fingertips. It has helped us to see things that are good, bad, and indifferent in our society through sharing from cell phone cams, things of that nature. And I think as we grow into this paradigm of change, hopefully, that it's definitely a thing which is needed. I'm fully engaged like I never was before in terms of social media and sharing, hopefully, something that's going to be somewhat. At least help people start to think about things a different way. I'm not trying to be, the teacher or the man who is angry about the situation because
like preaching a message or
yeah. I do have a certain way that I go about doing things. My way is very very slow and methodical, and sometimes missed because I do it that way. Anybody that's on quote unquote the Dwight bandwagon knows through listening to me and these meandering podcasts that I've been doing over the years, they kind of know my voice, and hopefully my voice in some form or fashion will reach somebody else that had thought a certain way and can help them to look at things from a different perspective. So yes, in a long roundabout way, yeah, I do hope that social media does help make a change, and I hope that it does help to start a dialogue between disparate energies to allow people to kind of get together and see things and see the bigger picture, man. You know, I mean, yeah. You know, this is not about some strange aliens from another planet that we've adopted and took into our house and called Clark. This is about human beings that have the same freaking blood and have lived in the same states and the same blocks and they're going to the same schools as your children have gone to. So you know nothing's going to change until people decide to change their minds about things, and the only way to do that is through dialogue and constant interface. And what I don't like is I don't like the browbeating. I don't like the in your face kind of sloganeering, if you will, that's used every 30 seconds, like with no kind of real nuance or no kind of sustainable intellectual process behind it. It's just a word, and it's just a series of words put together, you strung together to mean something, and it means something, it does. But it sounds very plain if that's all you have to say. It's like when I asked Johnny in the school, to answer to a question to the quiz, and he holds his hand up, and all he says is, peanut butter and jelly. Well, Johnny, can you elaborate on that more? Peanut butter and jelly, is it good to you? Do you like crunchy? Do you like the strawberries inside of your jelly? Do you like, grapes inside? What do you like inside your jelly? Give me some more alliteration. Give me some more expansive thought process than what's actually happening and occurring. So my goal is to try to establish some dialogue with somebody of any kind of, and I'm ready, I'm petitioning to take an ass beat behind this in terms of conversation, because I am not that dude that won't at some point get his buttons pushed, that won't go off on you if you go off on me, But I'm trying to learn to be a better person and learn to see things from a higher totality of existence, and that everybody's opinion matters, and that I want people to understand that, I bleed like you do, I have aspirations like you do. Let's have a conversation, man. Why do you feel that way? And a lot of times it's just ignorance. It's based on people that don't really want to, don't see the necessity for change. And because they're on that side, which things work for consistently. So, without going onto rabbit trails, I'm sorry, I'll bring it back in. I think definitely social media is a structural platform for that change.
Mm. Cool. What about you, Adrian?
Yeah, I definitely think social media has, helped, protests and activism, especially in these times. Like imagine if it was available back in, the civil rights era, the Black Panthers era. Like all they really had as far as like mass communication was, underground pamphlets, the Black Panther newspaper. That type of word of mouth to say, hey, we're massing to do this here. Be here on this date and this time so that we can do this thing. As opposed to now, you can reach worldwide and mm-hmm. let everyone know this is what's going on. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But you just don't. But like what Dee was intimating, you don't want it to just be, you know, empty platitudes as well. Like you do run, mm-hmm, right. you do run the risk of it just being like, you're saying the words, and some of the people that are saying those words don't really understand the weight behind them, the true meaning of what it is that they're saying, you know, and you don't want just armchair protesters, you know, and you could argue, since we're not out there on the front lines, we could be labeled as that, but not really, you know, because we're in that, you know, group that is being addressed. So in our own individual ways, as well as together, you know, we can, you know, affect some type of conversation or some type of activism without being out there on the front lines, you know, taking the tear mm-hmm. gas and taking, you know, the police charges and the batons like so right. many of the right. people are doing now. You know what right. I'm saying? And so it's a marked difference from what activism was, you know, over 40 or 50 years ago as right. to now. You know, I guess the only thing I would say to close that out is that, you know, it did seem as though with those prior decades of activism, and even up until and even through like the L.A. riots or the L.A. rebellion in 92, you know, there seemed to be a lot more galvanization of people towards this action. And I won't say you don't see a lot of that now, but it's more galvanized towards, you know, doing it all online, you know, as opposed to actually out there in the physical right. world, you know. And there's a marked difference as to how that proceeds, you know.
You think so, man? See, I think it's been up to notch, man. I think I see people. Here's why I knew this was bigger than George. God bless him, rest in power, rest in peace. When I saw our quote unquote brothers and sisters in England taking up the fight, I was like, wow.
Sydney, Australia,
taking up the fight, sir.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, Germany, sir, taking up the fight.
Germany, yeah.
I'm like, wow. This is going way beyond
and
the borders.
These are people over the pond who are holding up Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe. The same stuff that they see us doing here, they're doing it there.
Yeah.
So I think I don't disagree with Adrian. I think that, you know, the 60s was a different time period. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there was limited communication. Mm-hmm. And so now I think that social media for its, you know, it's good and it's ill. Mm-hmm. You know, I found out about Gamergate via social media. I found mm-hmm. out about Comicsgate mostly via social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that relate to, you know, activism in terms of like, you know, women's rights mm-hmm. and the glass ceiling mm-hmm. and how women are treated in the workplace. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the Me Too stuff that we found out about, we found out via social media,
mm-hmm.
you know. Social media has largely been the way that we have been able to keep certain names alive that preceded, sadly, and untimely deaths that preceded George Floyd.
Right.
You know, I was watching Van Jones on CNN, and he was saying that, you know, in a lot of black households, you know, these names are commonplace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Michael Brown, mm-hmm. Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner.
Yeah.
I mean, Trayvon Martin, these are names like, you know, some of the names that we've talked about in the past, you know, people from the civil rights movement, right. you know, who lost their lives.
Right.
You know, and you know, there's just a host of them, sadly, tragically. But, you know, also too, even moving beyond that, you know, like social media helped me as far as climate change is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, becoming aware of that and what that means and what, you know, what I can do to try to, you know, limit my carbon footprint, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So I think it definitely has its place. And I don't think that, you know, marching out in the streets is the only way to do things, you know. So.
Mm-hmm.
That concludes this episode of Sidebar Forever, hosted by Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson. You can find us online at sidebarforever.com. Any emails or questions can be directed to us at sidebarforever@gmail.com. And also, subscribe to us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Sidebar Forever is copyright 2020. Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson.